Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2024, January 5. And I be John Pazminer. Our lesson today is geomagnetic storms. That is to say, storms on the sun, solar flares, corona mass ejections, which, if they reach the Earth, would drive up the magnetic field of the Earth and cause a lot of electromagnetic effects, which can be damaging, critically or fatally, to many of our services and functions on the Earth. Before we get going, make sure that you have both files. You have the audio file, you're listening to it. You need the video file with the slideshow. If you're missing it, go to www.nyskies.org. On the home page, punch audio video files. On the AV files page, scroll down to the bottom. You can skip the text, you can look at that later. Scroll down to the bottom where you have the links for all of our seminars. And the one you want is near the bottom and is titled Geomagnetic Storms. And you pull down the PPT file, Papa Papa Tango, to accompany the narration you are now listening. That's the MP3, Mike Papa number 3 file. You would play the narration in background, and you have the PPT file in foreground, which you advance slide by slide by cue. So we assume that you've done all this, that you could pause, got the file, fired it up, and you're now standing on slide number 1. The number 1 deals with the quiz I left you with in the last exercise, which was the stars of winter. I asked then, why is Pi Day observed on 2 particular dates in the year, March 14th and July 22nd? For those of you who apparently are versed in mathematics or other technical field that uses the number pi, got the answer right away. Others were a little puzzled. So slide 1 gives the answer. It shows 2 calendar months, March, and 14th is highlighted, and July with 22 highlighted. And at the bottom I note that pi can be approximated pretty crudely as 3.14. And that notation can also stand for March 14th. It also can be approximated as 22 sevenths, that is 3 1/7. And that notation can be read 22 July. Those two values, 3.14 and 22 sevenths, are often used in high school math quizzes and tests where the instructions will say use 3.14 for pi, or pi is equal to 22 sevenths. It just simplifies the arithmetic. This is particularly in the era before calculus, where you had to do things by hand. But that is why we have the 2 dates, March 14th and July 22nd, as the twice yearly observance of Pi Day. Slide 2 is the title slide for today. It summarizes the AV files page in the web, except it assumes that you are looking at the slides, but you're missing the narration file. So it tells you to go back to the web and get the MP3 file. Having one without the other is a nonsense presentation. You need the both. I give two readings. One called Woolsey, Woolsey, which is a summary of a lecture that I sat many years ago, given by Woolsey, who was retired from the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, and he gave a very electrifying talk regarding electromagnetic pulse or geomagnetic storms. I forget which he emphasized, but he spoke about both. So that, I think, would be pretty much required reading, especially since in the recent weeks, in the fall of 2023, and even up to New Year's Eve last week, we were hit with many geomagnetic storms. Some of them were minor and weak. Others thought they would come to hit us, but they missed. Others hit other parts of the world besides the east coast of the United States. But we did get one big one on December 14th, which knocked out much of the radio broadcast and interfered with internet service. We could not make connection, or the server wasn't found, or things like that. And we have already, on several talk shows on radio and some news interviews regarding electromagnetic pulse or geomagnetic storm. The storms are one source of the impulse of electromagnetic waves, which can wreak havoc with the digital and electronic and electrical industries on the Earth. There are other causes for EMP, but today, as astronomers, we worry about what the sun does. The second one, blackout, is a summary of my experience with the Northeast blackout of 2003, which hit in the afternoon on a weekday, and we were dumped out of our office building, and since the trains were not running, I had to come home by knitting together several routes by bus. When I got home pretty much after dark, even though it was a summer night in the New York City area, and that lasted roughly 2 days. And so my experience with that is in the blackout. And that would give you some idea of what it is to live for a couple of days without electricity. In slide 3, we see the emblem for the International Geophysical Year. Now, I myself got into astronomy in the mid-1950s, and the astronomy club I belonged to had a big session. I think in 55 was when the year was announced, that is, planning was done, and the national science agencies around the world combined to have a all points, all hands on deck study of the interaction of the Earth with the Sun. Part of this was motivated by apparent interferences with electronics during World War II, which appeared to be induced by the sun, and part was due to the growing realization that many of the phenomena, such as aurorae, could in fact be caused by a material flow from the sun to the earth. That is, we understood already that aurorae are luminescence caused by ionizations in the atmosphere, which are timed to coincide with the ups and downs of sunspots. But we didn't know what caused the ionizations and what role the sun had in it. So the IGY lasted from July 1st of 1957 through December 31st of 1958. And that period was chosen to coincide with the maximum anticipated peak of sunspot activity in that year, sometime during that frame. And so with the sun at maximum activity, the geomagnetic, we didn't call it back then, the solar terrestrial interactions should be greater, and it'd be a good chance to get observations. And it was a very, very elaborate exercise where the countries would field teams all over the world to measure anything that could possibly be related to the sun. Certainly weather, ocean currents, wind, terrestrial storms like hurricanes. And then they got as involved as home astronomers to keep track of meteor showers. Well, we didn't know. Maybe meteor showers are enhanced or suppressed by the sun. Northern lights. Sunspot counts. Monitoring the magnetic field of a scouting or a hiking compass. Listening to certain shortwave radio stations like the broadcast time signals by shortwave radio, monitor them and make notes of the signal strength and clarity, and I think some others. But the home astronomer was a very, very strong sector in the International Geophysical Year, and there was a system of making the observations, recording them, sending the forms into a certain headquarters, a clearinghouse, and we certainly had a lot of fun, and it certainly gave me and other young astronomers of the era a big boost in our interest in astronomy. Now, of course, in the 1950s, everything was in print form. So if you did not, because you didn't think much of it, or you move, change location, stuff gets lost or whatever, you didn't keep the print material for a long time, really up until like 2000, you lost a lot of the history, but much of it has been recovered and scanned. So if you do a search on the web, an awful lot of material from the IGY has been put online by agencies that participated in it, or major libraries and universities. So the next couple of slides show examples of how home astronomers got involved in the IGY. This article here in slide 4 is an article from a journal which explains how the home astronomers, still called amateurs in those days, got involved with aurora observations and the value that was extracted from it. One little thing that we had a problem with: do northern and southern lights occur together, or were they totally independent phenomena? We just didn't know. But the IGY showed that they do occur, well, if not actually simultaneously, certainly with the same frequency on North and South Pole in step with the solar activity. Another problem we investigated was the Aurora Oval, O-V Victor A-L. Aurora had been known for at least 100 years earlier, into the 1800s, when polar explorations first got started, that the northern lights do not occur most prevalently at the magnetic pole, but are dominated by a ring roughly 1,000 kilometer radius surrounding that pole. But it was very, very sketchy information because the observations were haphazard. Sometimes it was travelers who, when they got to their home base, they report seeing the northern lights, but they didn't note the date, and they weren't really sure where they were. There's no landmarks up in the North Pole. But there was a suspicion that there's a zone around the pole where the northern lights predominate. Well, because we had the concerted effort, including dedicated teams of geophysicists going into the Arctic and also Antarctic, verified that the aurorae occur most commonly in a ring around the magnetic pole, and because it's not completely circular, it's called the aurora oval. It would not be seen all in one piece until the 1960s, when weather satellites got the first images from orbit. But that was another interesting outcome. Another we wrestled with is, how are the atoms in the atmosphere ionized to make aurorae, and the early satellites, and we'll mention this a little better, did discover that there is a flow of protons and electrons from the sun, and many of them are trapped in the inner parts of the Earth's magnetic field. We'll look at that too. But that all came from, among others, home astronomy observations of northern lights. Very, very few southern lights, because there just is no land masses that far south for people to live on and casually observe them. But no, they do occur. Slide 5 has a sweet spot in my heart. I did aurora, meteor, and sunspot observations. Meteors kind of bombed out because I lived in the city, in New York, and the sky conditions smothered the dimmer meteors, leaving only the bright ones, which didn't give very much of a shower effect. But the aurora was fairly easy to do. What you would do is you go out, scan the northern sky, note the hour on the watch, and fill out this form in slide 5. This is a copy of the aurora report card. It was made on stiff paper, like we use for greeting cards. One side had this little skeleton map of the sky with 30, 60, and 90 degree altitudes and the four quadrants from west, south, and we have the north, which is the third one from the left, and the other directions. And the upper left is the location and latitude of the observer, and in the upper right we had the date and time with the time zone of the observation, and at the bottom right you print your name. It wasn't a signature, it was just printed so you can read it, and a couple of tick boxes. No, number one is at the date and time according to the schedule, plus any other opportune times you may not have any aurora in the sky, so you tick that. If you actually measured the altitudes and positions of the features, you would tick that box. And if you had any additional notes or comments, you tick over where you put your comment. The back of this card also had a protractor or angulator. And the card, well, during the observation, you took that card and they gave us also a wooden holder, like a tiny clipboard, with a bob, a plumb bob. So when you center the card in that clipboard, the zero, or the center of the angulator, was at the pivot of the bob, and you slide along the top of the clipboard at the aurora, and then you with your thumb press the bob down and then take the card down and read the altitude. Really neat. You know, it was one of my earliest scientific instruments. I still have the clipboard and one or two of those cards, but they get pushed around from place to place in my house. But I was able to recapture this one for you. Slide 6 is a little curious. It was an international effort. And even though we entered the Cold War, which was essentially when Russia, after World War II, captured much of Eastern Europe, and then sometime like 48 or 49, it exploded its own first atom bomb. They were doing atom bomb tests, and so we had the Cold War, which was basically the missile race. Both Russia and the United States captured many of the German scientists who built the V-2 rockets, and which had dreams of a interplanetary German society, and they built rockets based on their expertise. And you actually did need a hefty rocket because the early atom bombs were very heavy, and the Soviets appeared to be winning that race. Certainly in 1957 they threw up Sputnik, which if I remember was something like 60 kilograms in weight, which is vastly bigger than any satellite we were even dreaming of launching. In any case, there was cooperation, you know, on a under-the-radar level between the United States and the Soviet Union in pure sciences. So this article here relates the observations of Northern Lights, or aurorae, from the Soviet Union. And I would not know then, in the 50s, that starting in 1975 and running to about 1990, I myself would be part of scientific exchanges to visit the Soviet Union three or four times during the depths of the Cold War, but we were colleagues under the stars. But that was during the IGY, this article. The solar cycle, or the sunspot cycle, is illustrated in slide 7, and it covers substantially my own entire career in astronomy, starting at the far left, 1954-55, and running all the way to the right, well into the 21st century. No, the number of sunspots is a normalized count assembled from lots of observations on the vertical axis at the left, and they have the years down at the bottom. And the number of sunspots, the sunspot cycle was demonstrated in the early 1800s. Yeah. Elias Loomis, I just forget the other guy, but there were astronomers then who realized from their own, and just by looking in the log books of observatories and so on, that some years had more spots and other years had less spots. And after a decade or so, they kind of got the idea that there is a rhythm to the ups and downs of sunspots. And we actually were able to trace sunspot activity by looking for aurora observations in the pre-telescopic era, tree rings, the annual deposition of dark and light layers in the trunk of a tree, and also I know in China and in Japan, I don't know how they did this, but they were staring at the sun, and every so often they would see a naked eye, like a large enough to see by eye, sunspot. And in European also saw this occasionally, but they assumed that it was Mercury or Venus passing in front of the sun. But we have a good firm record of sunspot activity since about 1600. Well, once the telescope was invented, there was no question about it. The sunspots were counted pretty accurately and confidently. But this series here, well, one thing you know, although the interval is pretty consistent, 11.1 year, the height, that is the maximum number of spots, which is an index of solar jivings, does vary rather erratically. Some people try to look at the whole 400-year period and see if there was a secondary long-term variation. There isn't. Statistically significant, there isn't. And so we had ups and downs. Now this is pretty interesting because if you read the article Woolsey, you will see that I started work in time for the 1968 peak, which is the second one in the series here. And I'll just give you the incipit of the story. You will have to read the article. Being fresh out of college and working for the federal government in the division that looks after electric utilities, which is the same outfit I stayed with until I retired last year in 2023. So put in 54 years of public service for you guys. So the second one, 1968, which I knew about as an astronomer, but the assignment that was given to me, because I'm the new guy, given something to do while he's learning the ropes, the boss comes to me and he tells me, okay, look, this file cabinet over here has reports, letters, faxes, telegrams about the disruptions to electric power systems. And they seem to be very frequent at the end of the 1940s and the end of the 1950s. The boss did not know anything about the ongoing solar cycle. He didn't know anything about solar cycles anyway. And so he gave that stuff to me. He said, sort this out. Maybe you can draw a graph of them or whatever, which I did. And the graph looked the spit and image of the first cycle in 1950 and the previous one from the late 1940s, right after World War II. And there were some notes in that file suggesting that these were disruptions due to sabotage by lingering gangs left over from World War II. The ones in 1950 were simply unexplained. Well, I went through all of this and gave my report and assessment and so on, and you'll have to read the article for the rest of the history. And then we have the others. By the 1970s, we already had put in orbit astrophysical and heliophysical satellites, by which we discovered the solar wind and the geomagnetic field and prove that the disruptions to electronics and electricity on the Earth were largely due to enhanced influx of the electrons and protons from the Sun and distortions of the magnetic field which let these particles reach the lower parts of the magnetic field or even down to the ground. And from then on, the utility industry and other electromagnetic based industries kept a vigil on solar cycles. But the first impulse of the cause or a threat was not from the Sun. In the 1950s and 60s, we were doing nuclear tests, and a consequence of those tests is that it disrupted and destroyed electric power and a lot of electronics in the blast zone. Though we put our tests in the South Pacific somewhere, and the Russians did so on land in Siberia, the effects sometimes were carried by the magnetic field of the Earth to other parts of the world. So the threat at first for the utility company was during a nuclear war. You would have the explosive bomb effect, you know, at ground zero and for many kilometers around, but the electromagnetic effects would percolate over most of a whole country. That was the original problem that the utility industry was dealing with. The solar activity cause wasn't really appreciated until like the mid-70s, and so they were on the alert for the peak of 1979 and 80, and thereafter they kept the vigil. Every astronomy textbook has a diagram or a picture, like in picture 8. Shows the sunspot maximum on the left, where the Sun has lots of spots and also large and complex groups of spots. And then at minimum, the Sun is either completely barren of spots or has only very few and tiny ones. And if anyone who has been doing solar observing and kept a reasonably complete record, maybe in a notebook of some sort, you can actually demonstrate this to yourself, or better yet, for the newcomers in your club or school, how the number of spots rises and falls over the years. So that's a standard picture. Sometimes you get a sequence, you know, every 2 years or something like that, but this is good enough. I don't know which year this is a maximum and minimum for, but this would be a typical flecked sun. I've seen there was a maximum in the one in 79-80. There were several of these very large spots, like the one you see near the top. And the minima are all pretty much the same, just no sunspots. But that is what we started to observe in earnest during the IGY. Before then, individual observers kept track of the Sun, but there was no coordination among them. Each one kind of invented its own way of counting spots. I know the AAVSO and the Zurich Observatory in Switzerland had a observing method, and some people adopted them. But in any case, the IGY systematized it and elevated it to a worthy exercise for home astronomers. And we kept that up until we started launching in the late 80s dedicated heliophysics satellites, which just keep track of the Sun directly And so the need for ground-based home astronomers to count or monitor sunspots kind of went away. But we use those heliophysical satellites to do solar observing anyway, even if we don't actually make records of what we did. The current and immediately past solar cycles are in slide 9. Number 24 is on the left, and actually that is a continuation from the earlier slide, which gave the sequence in the late 20th century. And cycle 25, the solid curve was the predicted or projected shape of the cycle. I don't know just how this was worked up, but that's what it was supposed to look like. The observations are the jagged hashy lines. Again, you have sunspot count on the left and dates on the bottom. And starting in 2022 and continuing all through 2023, we had a vast increase in solar activity, well higher than the projected for cycle 25, and by mid-December, early December, when I cut this picture for the winter sky exercise, it is quite the equal of the peak from the previous cycle number 24. I did not have the time to cut a brand new cycle picture, but you will learn later on toward the end websites where you can actually look for that picture. It's generated by NOAA, which is then percolated through solar observing or space weather webs. But that's the solar cycle as it exists right now. And we are already getting more aurorae, none yet in the city area. The Metro North part of New York skies, which is the northern part of our territory, did see them. And we did experience some geomagnetic disturbances. I mentioned the one on December 14th. There was another one in October. And we actually had several weaker ones throughout the fall, and a big one in New Year's Eve. The effect of the sky, that is aurora watching, and also in, say, electric power outages, were smothered because we had terrestrial storms like the one we had a couple of days ago after New Year's, and which is projected for the coming weekend. And the sky has been generally cloudy or rainy, so we couldn't even look for aurorae, at least in the New York skies area. So please, if you are outdoors after dark, not twilight, nighttime sky, for any other kind of work, such as Globe at Night, which is running right now, after you look at aurorae, make your assessment, swing around and check your northern sky. Know your geomagnetic north in the New York skies area and New York City. Geomagnetic north is about 30 degrees to the right of geographical north. That is, it's not quite all the way to northeast. So please make it a point on clear, if you don't go outside, have a viewpoint, a window, or stick your head out of a window and just say, okay, no aurora. If you see something suspicious out there, then go out and keep an eye on it. But that is what's going on with the solar cycle right now. But before all the modern conveniences of NOAA and NASA, at least for the United States, to alert us to the possibility of aurorae and other geomagnetic influences and effects, how the hell do you know to go out and look for aurorae? Well, the IGY did have a calendar with various dates which we were supposed to go out and look on, at least on those nights. But on our own, we used a rubric which was kind of hit or miss. In slide 10 is a view, a white light filtered view of a giant sunspot which had just rotated around to the Earth's side of the solar disk. It's a very complex spot, many umbrae, very textured penumbra, and the white areas, which look like spurts and bubbles coming out, are flares. There's a rather large flare because it actually can be seen at brighter areas against the photosphere. When these were first noticed in the mid-1850s, there was a fear that the filter they were using, which by the way was very dangerous at that time, the filter they were using may have cracked or had a puncture in it, and they were looking at the raw, unfiltered sunlight. But by putting in a new, fresh filter, and they saw, no, it's an actual enhancement of brightness on the sun, and with near the limb where we see it in side view, there's material being spit out. Those are the flares. So we see one of these. From past experience, we would know that 5 to 7 days later, after this guy rounds onto the front of the sun, we could expect, possibly, not for sure, with a bit of luck, aurora, northern lights. Now, it just so happens fortuitously that the rotation of the sun is around 28 days. That's the synodic rotation as seen from the Earth. So a sunspot like that would take a quarter period to reach the center of the disk, about 7 days. So we could watch that sunspot, and as it got close to the middle of the sun, we could go out and start looking for northern lights. And when that spot is well past the meridian of the sun, the middle line of the sun, we could knock off the aurora watch because the chance window already passed. And that's really how we did it. And I'll be honest with you, false alarms were far more common than good aurora shows. And indeed, we see a very nice, good aurora, a better one for our latitudes in the mid-north of the United States, we see in slide 11, blue rays on what appears to be an arc or band hugging the horizon. And anyone who has seen an aurora, now I'll say this, we have a session on aurora sometime way earlier in the year, or maybe in 2022. So if you want, go back to the AV files page and just do a search on Northern Lights or aurora. I forget the actual title of the session, and play that, because you'll need that information for being better prepared to recognize an aurora when you see it. Also, the supplemental reading on the title slide for that exercise is also something you should follow up on. Okay, so if you have not seen the aurora, you study still pictures like this, And there are some videos, but the videos tend to be time-lapse where an exposure is taken every 15 seconds or whatever. So it looks like there's fire shooting all over the sky when you play the video. Aurorae are kinetic, and the exercise on aurora will help you distinguish aurora from terrestrial illuminations in the sky, which you may not have known are temporary ones or brand new ones, which will assault your sky viewing. But that's a nice aurora. I wouldn't call this typical of the mid-northern latitude, but one of the better ones. I will say this, in the biggest aurora I've ever seen myself were right here from New York and in Long Island, and they covered the entire sky horizon to horizon in all directions and overhead. And some of the neighbors who heard the cheering and yelling and came out to look, they didn't know what the hell was going on. They thought the world was coming to an end. One of the most famous iconic pictures in the history of space travel or space science is in picture 12, and it shows the early space scientists that, well, I don't think NASA was created yet. There was an office in the president's office, the executive office, for managing the space program and the participation in the IGY. We have Van Allen, James Van Allen, who designed the spacecraft that's held up overhead, and we have Wanda Van Braun over there too, and some other guy, I don't know who. That is a model of, or a second example of, the Explorer 1 satellite. We were going to launch a space satellite as the signature event in the IGY. Well, the Soviet Union beat us to it. They launched Sputnik 1, and then Sputnik 2, and then Sputnik 3. But in January 1958, we did get our own first satellite, Explorer 1, because we knew we'd launch more. And then I think in February of 58, the Vanguard satellite was launched, and the space race was on. Now, Explorer 1, and indeed the intent of the first satellites, was simply to get the damn thing in orbit and have a radio beacon on it so we could track it. They ran on batteries, which gave out after a while. This guy also ran on batteries, which died after a few months. But the intent was just to demonstrate that yes, we can actually leave the atmosphere and have an object stay out there for a while before the drag of the upper atmosphere gradually slows it down and then it comes down to decay and burn up. But Van Allen, who helped to design this craft, snuck into it a Geiger counter. Well, he didn't actually sneak it in. I mean, the design that he worked out included a Geiger counter, and since the United States is going ape crap crazy because the Russians beat us to it, they just grabbed his design, okay, go build it and launch it and orbit it, which he did. The satellite Geiger counter, once it was in orbit, kept clicking. Rapidly at first, slow at first, sometimes it was silent. So they mapped out where these clicks were and the density, clicks per second, I guess, and came up with a remarkable discovery for the first major new geophysical event or phenomenon outgrowth of the IGY. Slide 13, there are many, many drawings and diagrams, some of them pretty ridiculous. This is, all right, schlocky a bit, but what the Explorer 1 satellite found was a torus or donut contoured along the Earth's magnetic field. That's the inner belt in this diagram, which was filled with electrons. Now, a Geiger counter counts the impact of electrons generated from radio decay of elements. In fact, you know, they detect a radioactive area, like a in a nuclear lab, let's say, by running a Geiger counter over your desk, and whoops, you're getting a lot of clicks in that corner there. You know, there may be some atoms from your experiment which spilled on that corner. Well, the electrons in the Geiger counters were trapped in the magnetic field of the Earth, and as the satellite moved into and out of it, you know, depending on its orbit, you got more or less clicks, more or less electrons, and they mapped out this Van Allen belt. And the Eureka statement that Van Allen yelled out was something like, "Oh my God, space is radioactive." What he probably did not know is that around 1900, another geophysicist, I guess we just call a scientist back then, Christian Birkeland, was doing experiments to try and find out why aurorae seem to trace the pattern of sunspots. And he built a lab, a box with glass walls, which was sealed, and it took some of the air out of it. And he had in it a iron ball, about half a meter diameter, which was magnetized, so it had like a north and south pole that represented the Earth. And his thinking was he needed to get electrons to make aurora around this globe. But where the hell are you going to get electrons? Well, the electron itself as a particle was only discovered a few years earlier, sometime in the 1880s, 1890s, and they were the product of radioactive decay. So he got radioactive samples, and he shielded them so the radiation of the electrons was in a particular direction. They also discovered that electrons can be accelerated using a magnetic field. So he built an electron gun, as it were, and fired these rays, as they were called back then. They didn't realize particle ray, you know, and into the chamber, and they followed the magnetic lines of force to the north and south poles of this globe and ionized the air in that vicinity. And some pictures of the experiment show that instead of causing the aurora at the magnetic pole, the aurora in the model, in his lab, was caused on a ring a little ways away from the pole. That would be the aurora oval. He cannot be credited with the discovery of the oval as such, because he could not correlate it to the actual observations of aurorae, which is still very, very spastic and erratic and sketchy. And even after we kind of understood what was going on during World War II, and then also the early days of aviation, which used over-the-pole flights to get from Europe to the U.S. or U.S. to Asia, we didn't really understand that we were actually passing through the oval. It took the IGY to verify its existence. And so he, in his eureka moment, said something like, "It seems to me, in order to explain the cause of the aurora, all space must be filled with electrons and ions." That was a conjecture for which any kind of proof had to wait more than 50 years. But in his honor, the streams of electrons and protons from the sun are called Bergeland currents. The outer Van Allen belt was discovered with future Explorer and other astrophysical satellites, and they are concentric with, at least, they also are contoured to the magnetic lines of force a little farther out. The outer belt, if I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to do this from memory, is around 40,000 kilometers at the equator from the Earth. And we did find that the electrons kind of swim back and forth from pole to pole. The protons go one way, the electrons go the other way, and they funnel down into the magnetic north regions of the Earth. So by around 1980, maybe a little earlier, we understood that the Van Allen belts in slide 14 are just the innermost part of a huge construct which we now know as the magnetosphere of the Earth. The magnetic field of the Earth actually extends very far into space. And I mean, pragmatically speaking, according to physics, it reaches out to infinity. But like gravity, beyond a certain distance from the gravity body, the field is so weak that it kind of blends in with the gravity field of other objects are out there. And the sun's magnetic field, which pours outward from the sun and has its own interact with it to give this distorted comet-like shape. The yellow arrows allude to the particle flow, the electron and protons, which are shoved out in enormous bursts, greater than flares. And that was discovered during the astrophysical satellites, would hit the magnetosphere of the Earth and would be entrained in the magnetic lines of force. Most of them pass harmlessly away from the Earth, as shown by the arrows on the top and the bottom. A extra strong burst could penetrate the weaker outer field and reach the denser, stronger inner field, and they feed the Van Allen belts and in extreme cases can even reach the atmosphere or ground on the Earth. Now the astrophysical and heliophysical satellites, because they were above the atmosphere, can explore the sun in wavelengths that are blocked or attenuated from the ground by the atmosphere itself. So the next slide there in 15 gives one example. This is an ultraviolet picture on the left, also on the right, of the sunspot maximum and minimum, and the white patches, this is all false color by the way, the white patches are flares, and they are most prevalent during the sunspot maximum. Now most flares are associated with, in a white light picture, a sunspot group, a very complex sunspot group, like the one we saw before, they were rounding onto the front side of the sun. But many others are not. They seem to be bursting out in places where in the white light image there are no sunspots. At sunspot minimum, there are substantially no flares. A flare can erupt, and indeed in 1962, a very major eruption occurred, and we saw the magnificent aurora in 1962 from New York City. In 1972, again, away from the maximum, there was a monster solar sunspot, which was huge, I mean, maybe 10 times the diameter of the Earth or thereabouts, and it rounded the sun. We did not get any aurora from New York, or elsewhere they did, and it was a very disruptive one for shortwave radio, which was still prevalent among home scientists and enthusiasts, and it wrecked a radio telephone, and it garbled some radio signals. See, so it can occur at any time. But that is how we can study the sun in different wavelengths. And toward the end of the exercise, you'll learn about websites where you can look at the sun, images that is, of the sun taking in a selection of wavelengths by the SOHO satellite, SOHO. Now, a flare is like a volcano on the sun. I mean, material from the sun, which is hydrogen, the sun's hydrogen. So protons from the sun during this eruption are heaved up into the sky, well, off the photosphere, but with a velocity too low to get it to the escape velocity of the sun. So it bubbles up and spurts up, then splashes back down onto the sun. One of the early discoveries of heliophysical spacecraft was, if you look now at slide 16, we show the distinction between flares pointed at the bottom, and at the top we have a super deluxe flare where a chunk of material, protons, is shoved so fast it escapes the sun and then moves off into space like the arrow. Where it lands, I know not where. But if the Earth be in its path, that cloud of protons can strike the Earth, either the entire globe or certain longitudes of it, and cause all kinds of disruptive effects. The SOHO satellite, which is probably the easiest one for home astronomers to look at because its websites were designed for space enthusiasts and home astronomers, as well as for campus astronomers and astrophysicists and geophysicists. So we can watch these eruptions, and by time-lapsing the pictures, which are taken roughly every hour, and we can actually see the movement of this cloud off of the sun, and it dissipates, and with a bit of luck, depending what you call luck, it will reach the Earth, and we will have the geomagnetic disturbances, which can be, you know, good in the sense of watching aurora, or it can be bad if you're trying to do telecommunications, and it can be disastrous if you're running an electric utility. But the discovery in the 80s, and especially in the 90s, of coronal mass ejections, or CME, is not, well, it depends what you want to call the corona. But the corona is all proton material anyway, so it effectively amounts to punching out a block of the corona, which immediately fills in behind it, and it sends it off into space. Now, it's sometimes hard in astronomy, especially for newcomers, to understand the scale of things in the solar system, well, leaving out the stars and galaxies, whatever, staying within the solar system, it's a little hard to appreciate the scale of sizes and distances, and a lot of diagrams that illustrate the effects or phenomena in the solar system are so badly distorted, you can get some pretty miserably wrong impressions. In fact, we'll be seeing very shortly such a distorted diagram. See, but here in slide 17 is a massive corona mass ejection. This stuff is not going back into the sun. It's a big bubble, and it'll move off God knows where. And in it is a inset of the Earth to scale. The Earth is about 1/100th the diameter of the sun, but it's hard to imagine this just by looking at a picture of the sun. So the author here in this borrowed image, and essentially every image in this exercise is borrowed, the Earth is put in there. I just put a title on it just to make it obvious. This mother is like, you know, about six times in width the diameter of the Earth, and about eight times in width in height. So these are gigantic on Earth or planetary scale objects. I suppose if you lived on Jupiter and were sentient enough to appreciate the activity of the sun, that thing there would be almost the size of Jupiter, or about the size of Saturn, the globe part of Saturn. So these are gigantic, but they move rapidly, covering the distance 150 million kilometers in roughly 100 hours, which is the kind of 5 days or so. And assuming that it is, well, let's see, the Earth is 12, 13 days, so let's say that is around 70,000 kilometers across, 80,000 kilometers across. Well, it would pass over the Earth in a few minutes. So a geomagnetic storm or a coronal mass ejection that does reach the Earth and hits it, say center on center, could last several minutes. It can do a hell of a lot in 7 minutes. Somewhat like a tornado. A tornado will pass over a point on the ground in a matter of seconds. But what it does to any structures at that point can be essentially annihilating. So the same thing with the corona mass ejections, which we generically call geomagnetic. Well, we actually call these a solar storm. That is one which actually does make it out to the vicinity of the Earth. And when it hits the Earth's magnetosphere, it transforms itself into a geomagnetic storm by warping, distorting, and bending and punching through the magnetic lines of force of the Earth. So the cloud of protons pours out of the sun, and if it reaches the Earth, we have the situation shown in slide 18, where it crashes into the magnetosphere of the Earth. Now, diagrams like this can be misleading in the sense that, well, there's no physical barriers, not like a dome or a guardrail shield surrounding the Earth. It's just that the magnetic field of the Earth happily is strong enough to deflect and streamline these protons around and away from the earth. But occasionally when you have an extra strong blob, it will push in the magnetic field and its own magnetic field, because after all, moving charged particles, protons are charged particles, moving charged particles generates around it a magnetic field. Anyone who played with electricity and magnetism, you know, you turn the electric current on a wire, it would deflect a magnet placed nearby, and because there's a magnetic field surrounding that wire due to the electrons moving through it. The same thing would happen here. So you would get the impact into the geomagnetic field, and depending on the strength, you would get a greater or lesser penetration down to the earth. Example of diagram all out of scale, every single picture that tries to include the sun with the earth is necessarily grossly out of scale. The sun is about 100 times the size of the earth, and in the scale here, well, I don't know what screen you're watching this on, but you would have to imagine that the sun is maybe 50 meters away or so. And then you have the geomagnetic tail here. So the distance scale is all wrong, and the size scale is all wrong, but just understand that in astronomy, it can be very difficult to draw a true size picture, or a true distance picture. Simulations like a solar system simulator can do this, because you can have the Earth, and then you scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll, and now you see the Sun. And now you want to go to Mars. Okay, so from the Sun, you scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll, and now you see Mars. And you see that Mars, compared to the Earth, or go back to the Earth, scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll, there's the Earth. About twice the size of Mars. But that gives you a little better idea of the scale and size than static picture. Even videos will show streams coming at you and warping around the Earth, and then they have an extra large puff on the Sun, and that punches through the magnetosphere, and so on. So just understand the scale, distance, and size distortions. We're not trying to mislead you. We're just trying to give you a concept which is downright difficult to appreciate in the first place. So how frequent are these geomagnetic storms or solar storms on the Sun? It doesn't become a geomagnetic storm until it reaches and hits the Earth. There are lots of solar storms which miss the Earth or which have minor effects. So slide 19 shows the frequency of solar storms. Well, actually, these are geomagnetic, so these actually reach the Earth. And they actually trace the ups and downs of the solar cycle. The most frequent ones occur when you have maximum sunspots, which, remember, sunspots were a visible and easily traced phenomenon on the Sun as a surrogate for general activity inside the Sun or in the corona or whatever, which really, until deep in the 20th century, we had no knowledge of or ability to observe. We rank the storms by strength: weak, moderate, strong, severe, extreme. And for each solar cycle is the count of how many there were. Well, the weak and moderate ones are the most numerous, and the strong, severe, or the least common, and the extremes are actually pretty rare. In fact, a couple of the cycles have none. A severe will do much havoc on the earth, and although there are maybe a few tens per year, or not, but per cycle, which is the 10-year interval when you have the peak, then you can have all kinds of trouble. But the number also varies from cycle to cycle in the same way that sunspots do. You can have a weak solar maximum, and therefore you have a moderate number of geomagnetic storms, or you can have a very high sunspot activity cycle, and you just get a lot more of these storms. So just be aware, right now, year 2024, following from 2023, and plausibly continuing for the rest of this year, we are in a very high period of solar activity, and we can expect a lot of geomagnetic disturbances. Now, before the space age, we really could not tell that by direct observation what went on at the surface of the sun and trace the glop of protons as it arced toward the earth. So predictions of geomagnetic storms prior to, let us say, the solar maximum of 1990 were kind of hit or miss. And there were a lot of really false alarms, which, you know, irritated people on the Earth. We made very expensive effort to prepare for the storm, which never came. But that all changed in the 1990s, beginning with the launch and fielding of SOHO, S-O-H-O, as shown in slide 20. On the left, because many of us see pictures of space probes, you have no idea how big these things are. So slide 20 on the left shows the satellite all packed up and ready to go into the payload and be launched. There's a man standing next to it. He's maybe 180 cents tall, or maybe 170 cents tall, so you get an idea. These things are big. And on the right is the fully deployed SOHO. It stands for, I think, Solar and Heliophysics Observatory, or something of that sort. But everybody in creation, including the people who run the instrument, simply call it SOHO. If you do a web search, be sure to include some other physics words like solar or satellite, otherwise you may get hits on the district in Manhattan that's a little bit north of Greenwich Village, and you may get actually a little bit south of Greenwich Village, my mistake, and also a district in London, also called SOHO. And I think there are some arts and craft companies or interior designers with the name SOHO. So make sure you put in something that say you're looking for the astrophysics or heliophysical satellite to monitor the sun. So what it does is it was placed in an orbit at the first Lagrange point number one. There are five, which are numbered sequentially, between the Earth and the sun. 4 and 5 are the triangular points, if you are familiar with Lagrange points, and 1, 2, and 3 are the linear points. So number one is the point that's about 1.5 million kilometers from the Earth in the direction of the sun. So the satellite stays there. Now, a Lagrange point is actually a gravitational attractor in a virtual form. No mass there, but the gravity fields of the Earth and the Sun combine to make it look as if there's a gravity field attracting objects toward that point. So the satellite actually goes in a little lizard-shoe orbit around that point, and it has station-keeping engines on board to constrain its wanderings. It has solar panels, which you see really splayed out that way, and it aims continuously straight at the Sun. The business end with the instruments and cameras are the module that's between the solar panels. The solar panels do not articulate or move because the idea is always to face the Sun and get the maximum power. If for some reason you have to turn the solar panels away, like approaching a meteor shower, let's say, the entire spacecraft is rotated. The back in the lower right has the antenna, which always points toward the Earth, by which data transponds between the mission control and the satellite. So that satellite was the first of now a battery of heliophysical satellites, some of which are actually dedicated to assess the oncoming threats of geomagnetic storms. SOHO doesn't do that directly, although its imaging and instruments monitor the flux of protons, electrons, and a bunch of other heliophysical parameters. And these are displayed on its website and is echoed to space weather and solar observing websites. So now with the SOHO and other spacecraft, we actually get an hour or so warning if a geomagnetic storm is headed and hits that satellite, or a bunch of them, and it's assessed to be, yep, this is something you got to alert people to. NOAA or NASA or comparable agencies elsewhere will issue an alert, and the recipients of that alert, which are industries that rely on electromagnetism for their facilities, will pick up the alert and have an hour to take action, either to prevent damage by changing the operation of their facilities, or prepare for restoring operations if damage occurs. So the solar storm on the Sun takes about 5 to 6 to 7 days, because it travels in a curving arc, in a ballistic path, and when it hits the Earth, and then the last 1.5 million kilometers takes about 1 hour from the satellite down to the ground. So that is how we now monitor, as a forward guard, if you will, to watch for oncoming solar storms, which by the time they hit the satellites will virtually for sure then pass over the Earth. An example of a geomagnetic alert issued by NOAA is shown in picture 21. This is just the first part of the alert. There's one screen and the page continues beyond under the picture for detailed information, plus other graphs and text and warnings and precautions and so on, including something about the parts of the Earth which may be hit and a range of hours when to expect the greatest strength of the storm to pass over the Earth. But on this first initial screen, just to catch your attention, it says right at the top the what's going on there, the geomagnetic storm on December 1st, and actually there are many others in December, and then it describes generally what's going on, and it says on the bottom some of the vulnerable systems on the Earth that could be affected. On the right-hand side is a picture of the Aurora Oval, which was taken by one of the geophysical satellites. In this particular instance, the Aurora Oval is very thick and broad, if you will, almost looking like a donut rather than a simple ring, and that indicates that the aurora intensity or strength of the display would be greatest. It is superimposed on a world map, and you can see the United States on the bottom part. The oval in this particular scene, which of course is obviously, you know, prior to the arrival of the storm. This is seeing this plus other heliophysical or geophysical parameters from, say, the monitoring satellites causes this alert to be issued, and the subscribers and the general public can then arrange for the weathering this storm. You don't get these directly unless you actually go to their website, the public website, or you subscribe to the alerts. And I'm going to warn you that alerts now, with the high solar activity, you may get them every week, or a couple every week. So you may want to just tickle the website every so often. The local news media get these alerts because obviously they're running telecommunications and they have an awful lot of electronics, and they do comms back and forth to their broadcast satellites and all that, so they get these alerts and they may relay them in the news broadcasts. The sum of the effects of a Gemini storm are shown in 22. I'll just highlight a couple of them. In the, you see at the top, stylistically, the clouds of protons from the storm raining down onto the Earth, into the orbits of satellites and down into the atmosphere, and at the bottom of the picture even reaching the ground. So in the upper left, certainly one of the big vulnerable systems are the orbiting satellites, the telecommunication, weather, military, astrophysical, resource monitoring, and all of that can be knocked out or compromised because of the influx of protons, that is helium nuclei, that were on the sun several days earlier. And on the right-hand side with the airplane, you see that avionics or anything else that's electronic on the airplane can be knocked out or interfered with and make navigation or just operation of the plane hazardous. And in the lower left, I'm missing a couple of them, a lower left we have that when the protons reach the surface, you generate high electric current, moving charged particles such as protons and also electrons constitutes an electric current, and that can be superimposed on the electric currents in the power systems, and therefore they could be knocked out or weakened or sent into erratic operation. I'm stressing in this exercise the effects of geomagnetic storms on the electric power system, partly because my whole career was working with the electric industry and having to deal with the geomagnetic effects every 11 years, and also virtually every other facet of society, even though they look like they're independent, like say the operation of satellites depends on a supply of power or energy from the electric power grid. So the operation of a satellite, oh, you think it's many hundreds of kilometers up in the air, it has solar panels, it doesn't have to worry about what happens to the grid on the surface. Well, it does, because the base station on the ground, which telecoms with the satellite is run by electric power from the grid. Also, when you built the satellite, the factory and fabrication was done with machines operated through electricity. And also, the airplanes, or the, all the equipment on the airplane is powered up and tested and checked out on the ground before takeoff with equipment run by electric power. In fact, you may even see at an airport where you have a window to look out at the gate, you may see heavy cables going to the airplane, because some are the fuel lines to fill up the airplane. And actually, the airplane is often fueled away from the terminal. So there are electric lines plugged into here and there to initiate and fire up some of the onboard avionics. So that is a major concern. So all society effectively today relies on a good supply, reliable, steady, dependable, of electric power. And if that gets whacked by a geomagnetic storm, everything is whacked. So slide 23 highlights some of the hazards to the electric power system. There's essentially two major elements in the power grid are of great concern. They're very, very vulnerable. One is the high voltage transmission lines that transfer power from the generating station to a load center, that is a place where the electricity is taken off and used by customers, or also to transfer electric from one part of the system to another. And then also at the bottom there it mentions transformers. Now transformers, as you may know from general physics, runs by alternating current. You need the varying magnetic field inside the transformer to link the current coming in at the primary end of the transformer to the coil at the secondary to generate a current in it. You cannot run a transformer on direct current, and the currents imposed on them, the transformers, by the geomagnetic storm is direct current. That cannot run the transformer, it just heats up the insides because the energy is going in, but it's not being taken out as output current, and the transformer could catch fire or burst or have burnouts or burn-throughs, and you lose your transformer. So if you lose a transmission line because of erratic voltage on the lines, which are added or subtracted from the operating voltage, or you lose your transformer, typically from overheating and breakdown, then you are losing major elements in the electric power grid, which could compromise major sections of the grid. A typical, you can call these things typical, a power blackout, where a large chunk of a country or even a whole country is without electricity because of a failure somewhere in the power systems. This one here in 24 is the blackout in the northeastern United States and parts of Quebec and Canada in 2003. This was not a geomagnetically caused blackout. It was caused by mechanical failures of some sort in Ohio. So it was a terrestrially caused blackout, but the effect is still the same. You got no power. So anything that runs on electric or depends on electric to operate or function was also out of commission. This blackout, at least in New York City where I was, lasted 2 days. It hit on a afternoon at work, and since there were no subways, and no street lights, and no traffic lights, and there are no toll gates operating. Everything was a free-for-all. I did catch buses, and I knitted together several routes to get back home. I got home after dark, even though this was an August summer day, and the blackout lasted about two, if I remember, it was two full days, and the power came back in my area near sunset or late afternoon. But it was rough going. I mean, we have gone through blackouts previously, so I do have some survival skills, but many people did not, and they suffered pretty badly. But that can happen because of a geomagnetic storm, and they did. Just that this happened to be a rather good picture taken from a weather-type satellite during the time of that particular blackout. In 25, there's a list of several, by no means all, other major sectors of a modern society that can be influenced by a geomagnetic storm. Now, the list here, plus other tests which I left out, try to show the direct impact on the facility or systems involved. But all of these, plus a whole bunch of more, have one thing in common. In order to even run at all, they require energy taken from the electric power grid. So even if the actual facilities and the equipment was not damaged, or that the operators were able to have a safe shutdown before the storm hit because they got the hour or so warning, they cannot operate at all if the electric power to those equipments and systems is not around. See, that's why in interviews, documentaries, science shows on TV, or radio talk shows, the conversation about geomagnetic storms, also called electromagnetic pulse, because some of the impact of the storm is to generate, by means of the high currents of these protons and electrons, electromagnetic energy radiating in all different wavelengths, which can influence and damage the systems. The reason they harp on the electric power grid is that so very much of the rest of human civilization rests on it. So while one host may talk about the calamity if broadcast AM radio was shut down because of the geomagnetic storm, the real culprit is the broadcast station and the offices and the electronic equipment runs off mains power. So while you may lose your carrier signal, you also lose possibly the whole rest of the operation of the radio station. Incidentally, on December 14th in New York City, a geomagnetic storm did wrinkle and interrupt AM radio in the mid to late afternoon. At the instant, the radio station didn't realize what happened because it thought it was a technical problem in the station, but very quickly, toward the end of the blackout, they realized, they found out the word that it was in fact a bump sent here from the sun. Okay, a very new additional vulnerable part of our society came in the 21st century. See, much of the literature on geomagnetic storms, it was written in the 20th century, and actually did cover pretty thoroughly what was vulnerable in that era. beginning in 2000, the manufacturer of motor vehicles had a strong shift from those operated with electromechanical controls to those built around digital and electronic controls. And since about 2020, I'd say that maybe just before the virus era in the United States, we had the introduction of cars with electric propulsion, where instead of a gasoline motor running the wheels of the car, you had electric motors attached to the car, and they were fed by a battery on board the car. And the controls for that are, because they are new vehicles, electronical or digital. So in slide 26, we have a picture of a electric vehicle being charged. Well, number one, the charging station will be knocked out because the electricity at the wall end of that cable comes from the mains power fed to it by the electric utility. And the vehicle will run, its battery runs down during a geomagnetic storm that knocks out your electric power, then you have no car. The car is stalled and essentially immobile. In other words, you have an auto immobile. If you have a non-electric, that is a conventional combustion car that was built after 2000, essentially or were, which had the electrical equipment run electronically and digitally or computerized, that could be zapped by the induced currents that are flowing down from the solar storm. So that's a new vulnerability. In blackouts in the 20th century, we had some help because the vehicles were electromechanically propelled, and therefore we could bring in repair crews, supplies, maintenance, rescue, and so on. You had mobility. In the next big blackout, and if the predominance of cars are computerized vehicles and even electrically propelled vehicles, you will lose that back door safety valve. In this exercise, we have 37 pictures, and therefore we're coming toward the end. I mentioned transmission lines, and 27 shows a bunch of them. These are in the state of New Jersey, and there's so many transmission lines there because it's a very densely populated area and also has a lot of high energy use industry. And the joke among utility industry and, you know, my office is that's a picture in 27 of the New Jersey State Tree, the high voltage transmission tower. The towers are built to carry the cable. Those are those sweeping arc wires from one to the next to go from a generating station, most of them being along the waterfront in New Jersey in this particular instance, and the electric is carried to the interior of New Jersey, or some is sold across the Delaware River or northward into New York State. So the high voltage is used for transmitting electric from the generating station or from a distribution station to other points in the territory of the utility or group of utilities at a high voltage. This is several hundred thousand volts. In New Jersey and nearby areas, 500,000 volts is the backbone or high capacity circuits, and there's lower ones, 230 volts and 110 kilovolts, and then lower than that is generally considered distribution that you see on poles along highways or in the suburban streets. But this is the line, the power line, the conductor, the wire, is subject to currents induced from beyond the ends of the transmission cable. You put the electric at one end and it's carried to the other end. But along the way, because it's all in the open air and typically much higher than the surrounding terrain, that is for insulation clearance, the wires can pick up current induced by the storm. If there's a sweep of protons across the earth and a cause of a current at low level or even in the ground, you could be imposing on that transmission line many thousands or even tens or hundreds of thousands of volts above the operating level, or on the other way around, a decrease in voltage. So the line looks as if, as seen by equipment at the ends, somehow was interrupted because the voltage dipped severely. And safety valves, the circuit breakers, may pop open and isolate that line to prevent the damage from percolating further into the system. So that is the one instance. The physical structure, the towers, the conductors, the fittings and fixtures, typically are not themselves harmed, but the current, when it reaches the end of the line, will jump into other equipment on the ground. And we'll see a substation, which is usually where these lines start and end. There can be a problem if the lines are heated excessively because of momentary extra current it's carrying, and the cable will expand by heat and sag and may get too close to landscape features such as buildings or trees and cause an arcing over, and basically a miniature lightning bolt, which is interpreted as a fault or a break in the line, and the line would be opened automatically. If you live in a large town or city like New York, you probably do not know what these lines look like. Now, we're kind of blessed or cursed, depending on how you think about it. If we just jump across the Hudson River to New Jersey, we see a scenery like in the previous slide. And similarly, if we go north of the Bronx line into Westchester, you see them. And similarly, if you go to the countryside, farther north or west, you also have them to an extent on Long Island. But if you're confined, or most of your goings about it in town, you probably do not see these transmission lines. What happens is they may bring the power to a distribution center on the outskirts of the town, where the voltage is converted to low level voltage and carried on what we call utility poles or telephone poles. Well, very few telephone poles are exclusively for telephones. And you'll get towers or poles like the ones in 28 over on the far left, where you have low voltages, only a few tens of kilovolts, and those are likely the ones that you see in the suburban districts. When you get into the open countryside, you have the classical lattice tower that you see in the center and on the right. On the whole, the higher the operating voltage, the more massive and taller are the towers, and that's to help insulate the conductors from each other and from landscape features, due to prevent arcing or sparks, and that would be interpreted by the safety equipment and circuit breakers as a short or an open line, and would then take the line out of service to isolate the trouble. You have the scale of heights on both sides, and these towers can get up there to 60 or more meters in height, basically the height of roughly a 20-story building. See, over the decades, essentially all throughout the 20th century, the 20th century was the era of mass conversion of energy use to electricity at the customer's end. Although commercial electricity started in the 1880s and privately operated or in-house electricity production started around 1860, the mass movement to install electric service generally throughout the population didn't get going until around 1900. In most cases, the town folk would see electric lights in stores, they'll see trolley cars, or they'll see a factory with electric machinery, but when they go back home, they light up their oil lamps, and they heat the house with a coal-fired stove and things like that. So there's no electric domestically available, or very little. But during the 20th century, electrification was promulgated and promoted very, very heavily, to the point where the individual electric utilities could not, on their own, furnish all the electric needed by their customers. They were assigned to territories by their states where they operated in, and as the population or economic and commercial activity increased, the utility could not itself build or operate its own power plants to supply that demand. So over the years, beginning about 1920, the utilities decided to link together so that another company with a larger power plant, instead of closing it or backing it off during its low power demand, they could sell the excess power to the neighboring utility and keep the plant running at fuller capacity, which would be cheaper, more efficient, and with less impact on the environment. So in slide 29, there's a map, it's a schematic map of the New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Maryland area of the United States, and the numbered dots are roughly where the various utilities operate. The key at the lower left, but this came from a trade magazine or a trade website, so the abbreviations may not be obvious. In some cases they are, like number 10, PSEG, if you live in New Jersey, the local utility, which is Public Service Electric and Gas, is commonly called PSEG. And if you live in Pennsylvania, number 5, Pennsylvania Electric Company, is commonly called Penn Elect. But some of the others you may not know. Connecting the territories are lines indicating 500 kilovolt, which is the highest high capacity voltage in this territory. The lines do not geographically line up with the string of towers in the landscape. It's just to tell you that, say, at the bottom, utility 8 near the lower right in Delaware is connected to utility 9 in the southern part of New Jersey, but the line joining is by no means the actual path of the transmission line between the two. The illustration here is to show that these are long distance, hundreds and more kilometers, and they're very high voltage, and an impact on that line in one utility could very easily propagate, if not trapped, to other utilities, and therefore the entire region may be in jeopardy because of a geomagnetic storm, not just the one area, which might be a stream tube of protons, which hits, say, southern New Jersey, but not in Pennsylvania, because southern New Jersey is connected to the rest of New Jersey and into Delaware and Maryland. That's called an interconnection. Indeed, this area is called the PJM, Papa Juliet Mike interconnection. And the interconnections are such that the utilities, instead of running their plants individually, they turned over the day-to-day dispatching, as it's called, of power from these generating plants to a consolidated system operator. And that system operator runs the whole set of utilities as if it was one large enterprise. 30 shows a substation or distribution hub. This happens to be a very large and very high voltage, the highest operating AC voltage in the United States, 765,000 volts. DC circuits, which have been coming into use since the 1980s, run about 800 volts in the United States. What looked like a giant jungle gym, and this thing here is roughly 100 meters square, what looked like a jungle gym, those are the actual cables, which are look like pipes, that are connected together here and there, and with switches and taps to shunt the power from one point to another. And in the lower left, and upper right, we see transmission lines, the normal cable type lines, which are entering or leaving this substation. So this can be a switching station where electric is needed to some territory off the screen in the upper right. The dispatcher may note that there's excess capacity on the power line coming in from the lower left, and so they may ramp up a power station off to the lower left, send the power into this substation, and route it through the switchgear to the power line leaving on the upper right. The other function of a distribution center is to change voltages, and this is done if you are interconnecting to a utility with a different voltage level, or to change voltage, say, from a generating station, which sends the electric out from its generators at a couple of tens of kilovolts, to put it onto the high voltage line, which operates in the hundred thousands of volts, kilovolts. Or the other way around, that could be a substation near an industrial district, so the high voltage from the transmission line is stepped down to a moderate level of voltage, which the factories can use on their premises. Such conversion of voltage is done by a transformer, a big mother of a machine, which is very similar, it's actually the same function as the little muffin or brick that you plug into the wall socket and the flying lead connects to your laptop or to your cell phone or other gadget to run. It takes the 110 volts from the mains and converts it through some low voltage like 9 or 24 volts, but also converts it to DC. All electronics runs on DC, and converts it to DC so that you can operate your gadget or recharge its battery. So that device essentially consists of two coils, one which is connected to the wall outlet, and another one which is wrapped around and entwined but electrically isolated is connected to the thin wire that you plug into your cell phone. And the both hug or wrap around an iron core, which is a ring or a square or a bar. In operation, the primary, and sticking with the little brick you put in the wall, the primary from the wall is 110 volts, flows through its coil and induces a magnetic field in the core of the transformer. That magnetic field induces a current in the secondary, which is the low voltage, like I said, like 24 volts or 12 volts or something like that, which goes into your gadget. So it is an exchange of voltage enabled by the magnetic interaction inside the transformer. So if you understand that, then you understand the next phase of this exercise. If you look at 31, this is the alien spaceship that landed just outside your town, and you probably drive past it on a highway or whatever, and you wonder, what the hell is that thing there with the giant horns? Well, this is a power transformer. Remember the one I explained about the brick or the muffin that you use for your electronic gadgets? Well, this is the exact same kind of a machine, stepped up many orders. The casing or the enclosure, the belly of it is about the size of a two-car garage in area, and about the height of about twice as high, not quite fully two floors in height, maybe say 5 meters in height. And the horns that you see on top are simply the bushings or the contacts onto which the power lines themselves, which are those pipe-like structures which you see attached at the tips. Now, I don't know if this is a step-up or a step-down transformer. I mean, this is just like a picture which was borrowed to illustrate the concept of a power transformer. But the shorter horns, or the shorter bushings, are connected to the coils of the lower voltage, and I'm just going to make this up, 138 kV volts in, say, upstate New York. And it is being converted to 345 kilovolts, again, in New York State, which then leaves the transformer through the taller horns and along the conductor to a power line and to wherever it has to go. So this machine is, apart from its physical size, is also pretty heavy, because it's all metal inside. The copper coils and the iron core, the whole thing weighs several hundred tons. It is delivered to the site in pieces, which the manufacturer then has an assembly crew to put it all together and prove it out, and then give you the keys to run it thereafter. These are not stock items. You see, for power lines, utilities must keep on hand for terrestrial damages and harm to the power lines. Extra cables, extra fittings and hardware, trucks and crews, and for the tall lines, they even have a couple of helicopters, and that way they can repair a line reasonably quickly. And if they run out of supplies or they don't have the proper amount of them, they can call on neighboring utilities to pitch in. Then they work out the financing and payback later. So this is done routinely in terrestrially caused storms, like winter storms we're going through right now. Trees will pull down power lines. High wind may topple a pole. A hurricane will rip apart a lattice steel tower. So this happens anyway, so they're prepared for that. In the case of a power transformer, the whole cost of this, you know, assembled on site and turned over to you to run, can be a couple of tens of millions of dollars, so say $20 million. It also takes a year and a half to 2 years to build from the time that you place an order with the manufacturer, because these are not kept in stock out in a storage yard someplace, and you, the manufacturer, such and such electric company, you need a step-up transformer, 138 to 345, a single phase, a single circuit. We have three of them. How many do you need? No, it doesn't work that way. They say, okay, you need a 138 to 345 single circuit transformer, all right, and they have some other technical specs for it, and they say, okay, we'll, 20% down, and the rest in installments, and we'll have it on your site, this being January 2024, well, January 2026, it'll be up and running. So these are items which, if you lose one for any reason, even a terrestrially caused event, like the pumps that circulate the insulating and cooling oil through it, breaks down, or because some oil leaked out and a careless person accidentally set it on fire, or a motor vehicle went wild and rammed into it, you're in for a major long-haul repair. So these power transformers can be affected by geomagnetic storm, because those storms generate direct current. It may be fluctuating in value as the storm passes over, but it's all electricity flowing in one particular direction, which also will flow through the iron core. Iron is a conductor. But transformers cannot run on DC. As one of the early discoveries with the behavior of electricity in the early 1800s. And what happens then is the electricity runs round and round through the core, and its energy is not picked off at the secondary coil, because you do not have the varying magnetic field to induce the current in the secondary and thus take off that excess energy. So the core heats, drastically so, to the point where the air pressure and oil pressure inside burst the tank, blow off the bushings, and the whole thing melts down in a fire. And of course, without the transformer, you lose the connection to it, and whatever power lines came in or out have to be pulled out of service, and they're gone. And if they are critical lines, you may percolate a blackout elsewhere throughout the system. So power transformers are the most vulnerable in the sense of repairing or restoring them is not a trivial matter. Another fact which is lost on people today. When I was working during the 20th century, you could get a transformer from one of the big electrical companies in the United States. Sometimes the company that built the generating station will also build the transformers that will take the electric out of that station. And that's an American, like Babcock Wilcox, or Westinghouse, or General Electric. But over the years, American transformer manufacturing died out. All power transformers that the United States needs are purchased overseas. Now, fortunately, they are purchased from friendly countries, South Korea, Germany, Sweden, Switzerland, as you said, Japan. But I know of a couple of instances which, while composing this exercise, I learned that China, Red China, is in the market for transformers, and they are building them and offering them to American companies, sometimes at a loss leader. Oh, you were thinking of buying that Swiss company's transformers for $22 million, you know, we can build one and sell it to you for $12 million. And the Chinese government subsidizes it, and who knows what spy equipment was built inside of it, and who knows what remote control is built inside of it. So if the United States government gets on the wrong side of Red China for some reason or other, the Chinese government can mash a button and shut off that transformer. So we don't know that, but the threat is real, and we have seen that in internet equipment. So a power transformer is one of the real China dolls, excuse the expression, which can be knocked out with a BB pellet, the geomagnetic storm. The remains of a transformer which was blown apart by a geomagnetic storm, well, the proximate cause was a fire. That is, the crew at the substation here saw the transformer catch fire, and by the time they were able to pull it out, this is the mess that's left. And then when they got back to the office to do up the report, then they learned that it was a geomagnetic storm that swept over the substation. That is the and that transformer is a total loss. They had to cut it apart with acetylene torches and sell the pieces for scrap metal. The home astronomers took a interest in electromagnetic pulse, okay, partly because it makes their livelihood and life in jeopardy. Also, sometimes an outgrowth of, say, their interest in solar physics, or they were sun observers previously. Now, when the SOHO satellite was launched, well, internet was still very new for as a public utility service. Internet is a utility service, like telephone or newspaper delivery. It's a utility. So the site was designed, and it's tinkered with from time to time, to be easily used not only by scientists and campus astronomers, but also by home astronomers and enthusiasts. So this is one, the home page. If you just type in, do a search, SOHO plus satellite plus solar, you land here. And I'm not going to go through all the features. It's a very, very complex website with many, many rooms, many, many floors, if you can think of it as a office building. And the different features include views of the sun in almost real time, maybe an hour or two lag, viewing the sun in various wavelengths, in white light, in assorted lines of the solar spectrum, and you also get graphs and bar charts of heliophysical parameters. And so you may want to bookmark the site or the pages within it of interest, and that way when you get an alert or a suspicion, or you just want to muck around, you can do that. They also have videos which are simply flip-throughs assembled from sequence of still pictures. Like I say, they're taken about an hour apart. So if you look at a video of, say, a solar flare, you actually see the stuff heaving up out of the sun and then falling back in, although the actual event may occur over several hours, you see it go through in a minute or two. So this is a very fun sight to go to. Two other little uses very early on, besides solar interest for the SOHO site. One section is called LASCO C3. It's LASCO space, letter C, number 3. And that is a camera with a 7-degree radius centered on the sun. And the sun is hidden behind a paddle. There's a small circle drawn on that paddle to indicate the actual diameter of the sun. And spitting out around the paddle is the mid and outer corona. So far, so good. In the background are stars. The camera, just by its design, also captures the star field. So what we've done almost immediately, when a planet reaches conjunction with the sun, normally you couldn't see a planet. Until SOHO, the only time you could see a planet close to the sun near conjunction is if the conjunction occurred during a solar eclipse. And I've seen a couple of these where one planet or another is close by the sun a few degrees away, which would be impossible to see under ordinary circumstances, not even in twilight. So as the planet is crossing behind or in front of the sun, the north and south typically, we actually see it as a bright star plotting across the field of view by looking at sequential pictures taken by the LASCO C3 camera. The other use, which was a bit fortuitous, although the expert observers for comets hit on this, there is a category of comets called Kreutz comets, K-R-E-U-T-Z, Tango Z Zulu, after the German astronomer who first discovered them in the late 1800s. He discovered a very bright comet which was seen in a darker sky, but the orbit, when traced, skimmed the sun passing through the corona. Well, it turns out that in the 1980s, a couple other brighter evening comets or dawn comets was found, which followed in virtually the same orbit as sun grazers. Couldn't we see these sun grazers near the sun in the SOHO pictures? Well, the answer is yes in spades, because we didn't just wait around for a bright one to come by. There is a continuous stream of faint comets which could never be seen optically from the ground, but are in the SOHO pictures. So many of us home astronomers studied these LASCO pictures for comets next to the sun. And by now, collectively, home astronomers have discovered, now, I hope you're sitting down for this, 4,000 and more of these Kreutz comets. They don't get their name attached to them because they didn't physically observe them in the sky themselves, but they are using data collected by a project, the SOHO mission, the SOHO satellite. So these are numbered and are credited to Soho as the actual collector of the information, but the discovery notice does note that Mr. So-and-so in such-and-such town calls attention to a great comet, Soho number so-and-so, and then you give the description and orbital elements. So that's another use of the Soho satellite, the watching of planets go through their conjunctions with the sun, and comet hunting in a new and novel way. NOAA itself, the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, also has a very good website offering dashboards, as they call it, or a console, as I would call it, for different areas of society which are affected by geomagnetic disturbances. So the page that lists these, and you can pick what you want, is shown in slide 34. And we have one for satellite operations, for electric utilities, for Aurorae. But the one that you really want is over on the right, that's called Space Weather Enthusiasts Dashboard. Now, I looked at all of these to see what may be otherwise available. It turns out that all of the others are subsets or segments taken from the enthusiast board. So if you bookmark the enthusiast board, you will have all the information that the others contain. And the reason for segmenting it like that is someone looking at Aurora will want to look at, say, the Aurora Oval, the X-ray inflow, outflow from the sun, and maybe something else. So those pieces were collected on a console for Aurora enthusiasts or Aurora monitors. And that is used for people who are concerned about telecommunications, because the upper atmosphere transfers radio waves. And the electric utilities also have their special interest. But they're all in the enthusiast board, so I would just go ahead and bookmark that one. You would look for it, NOAA, N-O-A-A, enthusiast dashboard, and the homepage of the dashboard should come right up among your hits. The 35 shows one of the segments within the enthusiast dashboard, which is more for the sun. And you have a white light picture in the middle, and it's an ultraviolet, I forget the wavelength, on the left, which emphasizes the flare activity. And on the right is the view through the LASCO camera, which I described earlier. The field is artificially colored blue. You see the pattern hiding the sun in the middle, the jets of the corona shooting out, and little speckles here and there in the back are stars. For those of us who are really keen on Aurora, we'll go to the section on that dashboard shown in 36 for Aurora. And on the left is a snapshot of the oval, which in this particular day is not a complete oval. It's very, very weak. But the lower right section is pretty dense, which is the aurora activity at the instant. And again, you see the outline map of the world and the United States on the lower part. On the right-hand side are the various heliophysical indices, which are useful for assessing the probability of aurorae. The most common used is the bottom one, where it says KP, or the planetary KP, kilo papa, and the value of that on the scale on the left will be a index of the chances that your location will have a shot at seeing northern lights. You will have to know, and I urge you to go hunt up that Northern Lights or Aurora exercise back on the AV Files page, where you have a table showing the Northern Lights KP contours that you can spot your location on, and if the KP value is such and such or greater, then that is where you should be out there scanning for aurora. In this particular instance, the KP index is very low, which you can kind of guess that by looking at the oval, which is fragmented and not even complete. Now, so far I've described from the enthusiast, from the astronomer, from the scientist, from the technical viewpoint, the idea of solar storms, geomagnetic storms, effects on the power grid. But what about the average man, your next door neighbor, who doesn't give a whit about science or astronomy, whatever? How the hell does he learn about geomagnetic storms, and should he even be worried? So the last of our slide 37 gives three examples of news media alerts due to splash screen during the news broadcast, and then a voiceover from the narrator, and what he does is something like this. Okay, for our next news item, I got something right here, right off the teletype. Oh, rip and read, let's see what that says. Oh my goodness, wow, oh. We have a geomagnetic storm. Now, what does that mean? It says here that the Earth will be bombarded by particles from the sun, which will cause blackouts and will shut off the electric power starting, it says here, 10 o'clock tonight. So please be careful with your electric usage after 10 o'clock. And now we have a station break for our sponsor. This is Acme Emergency Generators Company. If you're afraid of an electrical blackout, be sure to be prepared. Our generators run on your wind power, which will power your whole house and will kick in automatically. Please go to, and see what happens? That's what happens when you have a public announcement of a geomagnetic storm. That concludes today's exercise, and now for your quiz. I mentioned for transmission lines and the general operations of utilities that the output from the generating stations, which is only like 10, 15, 20, 25,000 volts, is boosted to several hundred thousand volts to go on the high voltage lines to their point of use or interconnection. Why do we do that? Take, for instance, the wall sockets in your house, 110 volts. Why doesn't the utility company generate at 110 volts, put it through wires, and connect to the sockets in the wall at 110 volts, and avoid all the use of high voltages and the steel ugly towers the birds ram into, and helicopters get trapped in, and skydivers get tangled up in, and transformers that can blow up or they look like alien spaceships. We don't need all that. We can generate at 110 volts and just send through wires all over the city, and it comes out in your wall at 110 volts. Now that is not an astronomical quiz, but it's a technical quiz, and if you do any work with electricity, not necessarily in utility, you may work in a warehouse or a factory, and you're familiar with the electrical power coming into your facility and where it arrives from the outside, you will know what the reason is. So explain to me, as your quiz, why do we use such high voltages on transmission lines instead of the moderate voltages that we ultimately use on our premises. So, until next time, pray for clear skies.